This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Very soon on the show.
No, we don't want to have to deal with carb. No, we don't want to deal with carb. We've got to get rid of the carb.
Yes, we are talking carp because it's less than 2 months until a recommendation will be made to the government on if the herpes virus should be released. Also this half hour, something that's definitely needed as the ongoing dry continues, researchers have developed a tool to help breeders develop more drought-resilient wheat crops. And we know that South Australia produces more than half the country's wine. Well, a new report is saying that the Australian wine industry has fully recovered from its oversupply issues of the past decade. You'll find out how it's made that turnaround after the weather. But first today, the coordinator of the National Carp Control Plan says it will make a recommendation to the federal government before Christmas on whether the controversial herpes virus should be released. But it hasn't looked into the risk of the virus spreading outside of Australia. The government provided a 12-month extension to the plan, but since then, there's been no new funding or new research topics. Jamie Allnut took over from Matt Barwick as the coordinator of the plan. Mr. Allnut says spending money on researching the spread of the virus outside of Australia isn't warranted because it's largely known how the virus spreads across the world.
We've been looking specifically at how the virus works overseas. There's probably a whole lot of other reasons why it doesn't occur in some countries, but no, that hasn't been a focus of our research. So we've certainly been focusing our research about how the virus may work in Australia, but looking overseas to illustrate how it's worked overseas.
Do we have an obligation, given that the disease is listed by the World Health Organization, to at least evaluate it spreading to other places and causing harms and finding a way that's responsible to release it to avoid that?
Yeah, look, there has been work done overseas. All the scientists have read all the literature about the reasons why the virus spreads. A lot of those are to do with aquaculture and movement of fish by people. So they're the predominant reasons. So that doesn't really give us any valuable knowledge that we need to use for the NCCP. I can't see the benefit of us unpacking that in detail.
About how it could spread from Australia?
About how the virus has moved around the world. We largely know that already. There's no point in actually unpacking that, spending, important research dollars on unpacking that issue further. And certainly all our scientists have done literature reviews of all of the work that's been done overseas and all of the research on the virus from overseas.
Has there been any new research, given that there's been no new funding from the government and what was provided has already been used, has there been any new research, or it's really a continuation of the research projects from last year?
Yeah, look, we've had small variations to research projects, and that's natural. As you get to understand the topic, you learn that maybe there's some more we can do. So we've had slight variations to research projects. We've done a few planning investigations. So we've been using that money as we go along to spend it to ensure that we can write a plan which answers the questions, is this feasible? And if so, how it could be done.
But there hasn't been any direct new topics. It's been what was currently being looked into.
Yeah, broadly, as soon as the NCCP started, we set up a science advisory group, and they sat down and worked out, well, these are all the themes we really need to research in. We've then gone away, and these are the questions we need to answer. We've then gone away and contracted that research. We've got leading scientific organisations like CSIRO to do that research.
Okay. And so how have you sort of managed to do that without any additional funding? Because all the funding, the $5 million that was allocated from the government was used last year.
Yeah. So look, there was always, some, there always needs to be some contingency in budgets to deal with issues that arise, and that's what we've been able to manage.
Because extra funding's been given, or
no extra funding's been given, but the research program has been implemented, and when you design a research program, you're open to slight changes in that research program, and that's what we've been able to implement. We haven't needed extra money to do that.
According to last year's timeline, a draft plan was due to be delivered a few months before a recommendation was made to government. Now, you've had a year's extension, but if we're looking at that timeline, I mean, where is the draft plan at?
Yeah, so we've got a draft at the moment, so we're finishing that draft, and we're talking to government about that, and then that goes to government as planned at the end of the year.
So is there feedback on that draft plan before the final recommendation in December?
Yep. So we've got our advisory group structure set up, and we've got governance systems set up, including a couple of advisory groups. So we're going to those advisory groups and getting feedback from them, and that's what we're doing at the moment. There needs to be, it's important to recognise that this has to go to government for a decision as whether to proceed or not. Based on what the government decides, it will then need to go to public consultation. So there will be a lot of stakeholders are really interested in this, and the community is really interested in it. Depending on what happens with government, there will have to be, if a decision is made to proceed, there will be a consultation period later on down the track.
What has the draft plan recommended?
Oh, we can't divulge. That's for government to consider. So we've done a comprehensive research program, and the draft has direct line of sight to that research.
And I've spoken to some researchers who say that they haven't seen a draft plan. I mean, has the draft plan been given out to everyone involved in this?
Yeah, look, we do have a draft. It hasn't formally been sent to everybody, but that's all part of the process. And we've got a meeting coming up in the next couple of weeks. So the drafting's on track, and we're consulting with our advisory groups as part of that drafting.
With what we saw in Menindee with the fish kills last summer, and I mean, if there's large numbers of dead carp, which would remove oxygen from the water, and given that the drought is continuing, I mean, would we likely see more of those fish kill events if the virus is released?
Yeah, so it's a natural fish kill, and this is one of our research projects is looking at what we call of epidemiology, how the virus will work to draw down carp populations. And it's something quite different to a natural fish kill. Like a natural fish kill, the fish largely die all at one particular time. With the carp virus, it'll be different because it'll be a managed release. We'll have knowledge about where we're expecting those fish kills to be. There'll be fish kills in existing carp aggregations, so we'll go to those existing carp aggregations and we'll release the virus into those. And then the virus will gradually move through that particular aggregation. So it's not going to be like a natural fish kill where large amounts of fish within a water body die all at once. So it's quite different.
That's the National Carp Control Plan Coordinator, Jamie Allnutt, and that draft plan won't be released for public consultation. There's been lots of concerns raised, even within the scientific community, continually about the timeline and funding on this plan. I'd be keen to get your thoughts about what effect you think the potential release of the herpes virus would have on you or your region, and about whether or not it is released. 0467 922 783 to send a text, or you can also give us a call on 1300 222 891. The plan, the proposed plan to release the carp herpes virus as a method to control the species has been labelled reckless by a South Australian commercial fishing body. The chair of the Southern Fishermen's Association, the group that represents commercial fishers in the Lower Lakes and Coorong, Gary Harris-Singh, says the problems the invasive species cause do not warrant the release of the virus. He told Grace Whiteside more research is needed into the potential decline in water quality.
Well, it's not like a terrestrial or a land-based virus. This is a virus that's actually in a column of water, and you really don't see the impacts, and particularly the secondary impacts that affect other plants, other biota, other animals, until it's too late, and particularly if it's a negative impact. And what I'm saying is that while it may kill a lot of carp, there are going to be an awful lot of survivors, and every offspring will develop a strain that is more adaptive and more resistant to the current virus. And so for unknown consequences on the rest of the ecosystem, someone is prepared to take the risk of introducing a virus that nobody is definite or clear about the impacts that it may have on the whole Murray-Darling Basin.
You don't think there's a way that it could be managed appropriately?
Not at all. Not at all. Once the virus is in the water, it's there for life. That concerns me.
Exactly what sort of impact would it have on yourself and the other fishermen?
Well, the fishermen are highly adaptive. We've been, this fishery has been around for 165 years. And so if the virus did wipe out all our native fish because of the bacterial levels and deoxygenation in the water, and there was this cascade effect on other organisms, the fishermen would adapt. But once the water turns toxic and we are continually in a dry period, then I see major, major problems for the ecosystem and the quality of water. There are thousands of people that rely on potable water from the River Murray, whether it be Whyalla, Morgan, all the upper southeast towns, Tarlambin, Canalpin, Kintanara, Keith, Meningie. There's a whole bunch of country towns that rely on potable water from the River Murray. And then there's stock water. And I'm saying that if the water becomes toxic, then nobody is going to have any stock water.
Chair of the Southern Fishermen's Association, Gary Harrising. The Murraylands and Riverland Local Government Association says it's not opposed to the release of the virus, so long as the clean-up effort is properly resourced. CEO Tim Smythe says it's still unknown who would be responsible for the clean-up.
From a local government perspective, our concern has been and will continue to be and will continue to advocate on the matter of the clean-up, the undertaking for cleaning up in the event that the carp control plan is implemented. So, obviously, it's a vast network, the Murray-Darling Basin. But, you know, that said, I guess we've got to place our confidence in those people that are undertaking the necessary studies, particularly in, you know, some high-risk areas where the carp biomass is dense. There's a high density or a high number of carp, and where there's going to be public interaction.
And how it stands at the moment, who is responsible for that clean-up?
Oh, look, that's a very good question, but my answer is that... off the top of my head, I don't know. We at a local government level, we have no understanding that task would fall on us without significant help from the other tiers of government. So I guess that's where we stand on that matter. We're certainly not against it. We recognise and understand that there could be significant environmental benefit from a dedicated and targeted plan to eradicate carp. I think there's a general understanding that a single release of the carp herpes virus is probably not going to get the carp all in one hit. So I guess we've got to look at this from a holistic perspective about how we undertake this task using a number of instruments over a period of time. So we're certainly supportive of it, but we understand that there's significant risks if it was poorly implemented.
That's Tim Smythe, CEO of the Murraylands and Riverland Local Government Association. There were social surveys done a few months ago, and unsurprisingly showed that if there were lots of dead fish killed by the virus, it would likely put people off the water, and they're less likely to swim in the River Murray if it was full of herpes infected carp. I'm keen to get your thoughts. What do you think a potential release of this carp herpes virus, what effect do you think it would have? Is it something that you support? You can send us a text on 0467 922783, or you can also give us a call on 1300 222 891. Dave here on the text line saying, how long will the virus live in soil and sediment? That is definitely worth following up. We've also got Tom has called in. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Good afternoon. Just a couple of comments, if I may, please. I'm not directly involved in any way, shape or form, but As an outsider looking in, apart from the obvious potential problems that some of your other people have mentioned about, we don't really know the full outcome of the virus long term for the rest of the river. My point of view is, only in a country like ours where we're too well fed and too bloody fussy would we basically kill millions of fish and allow them to rot, or at least go to landfill, instead of being actively promoted month by month as a food source for Australians, only in a country like ours would this be a problem. No other country in the world where people need a food source would carp, or for that matter, wild rabbits, be considered a pest and treated like this. They're a food source. They should be promoted by the fishing industry to make money out of and to feed the Australian people.
And there's there's definitely been calls for that, Tom, because we ran a story a couple of months ago on the Country Hour from fishermen in the Coorong area saying, you know, can this be turned into, why can't we be commercially harvesting that? We have heard from people saying that that is not a sustainable solution to remove all the carp, but there definitely has been calls to harvest them and to eat them because, like you said, people do eat them in other countries. I've definitely eaten it in England. Have you yourself had carp, Tom?
Plenty of times. When I used to... backwards and forwards into Victoria, and I actually fed them, I cooked them, prepared them myself and fed them to local-born Victorians in the irrigation country area who swore they would never eat carp, and they wolfed it down. They didn't know what the bloody hell it was, and they loved it. Yeah, it's just a matter of actually preparing it correctly and also not having the stigma attached to it. I mean, seriously, and as far as it not being sustainable by fishing them, if there's money in it, we will overfish them. Simple as that. You know, if people are making money, we'll keep going until there's not much left. That's pretty much our general way of approaching things anyway. But you've got to actually make them a viable economical resource and actually put a price on it where people will want to buy them and teach people how to actually treat them and how to cook them and actually actively go out of the way to encourage more and more Australians to actually eat them. The money will be better spent doing that rather than releasing something that nobody knows what the hell is going to happen to the other life in that river. This is crazy.
Thanks.
Absolutely crazy.
Thanks for calling in, Tom.
Thank you very much, love. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You can also join the conversation 1300 222 891, or you can send us a text on 0467 922 783. Tom's saying, why can't we just eat them? I mean, do carp have a bit of a marketing problem? They are eaten in some countries in Asia. They're seen as a bit of a delicacy. So should we just be eating them? I mean, we've heard, obviously, though, that fishing them might not be the right solution there. Another text here saying, with the carp virus not in favour, much rather invest that money to subsidise fishermen to physically remove and also have habitat restoration. Thanks for that text. 0467 922 783 to join the conversation. And Dave, who texted in earlier, has also called. Welcome to the Country Hour, Dave.
Yeah, how you going, guys? Yeah, listen, this government, oil government's bang on about biosecurity, but what's to stop someone either taking some water or an affected fish into other rivers?
How
are they going to police that?
Or a bird? I mean, we've heard that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, we've had that trouble before with lots of different things on so-called pest animals, whether you want to go for cane toads or rabbits or whatever. But everything's transferable in nature. Once it's in nature, you can't hold nature back. But if someone wants to do it deliberately...
What do you make of what Tom was saying before about fishing for the carp and sort of trying to market it differently and people actually eating them and not seeing them as they have been, which is what they are, a pest species?
Well, he's right that we're a selfish country, but what he said is true. But it's, you know, how long has it been going on about carp? You know, so it's right, we waste so much food as it is, but you've just got to get someone to come up with the idea, and if they get backing from the government, but then the government might pull the plug and say, well, hang on, it's not good enough, so we're going to do it anyway.
Dave, thanks for your call as well. Dave there calling in on 1300 222 891, keen to get your thoughts on this. You can also send us a text 0467 922 783.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
where it is 24 past 12 and I'm Isabella Peterway. Great to have your company this Thursday. Pune Kerry on the Lower Darling has been relying on emergency water supplies for nearly 12 months since the town's weir pool dried up. The dire water situation has locals demanding action and better infrastructure to store water for when flows return. Now, Trevor Smith and his father have been advocating for a higher weir at Pune Kerry for years. They believe a taller weir would stop Pune Kerry from running out of water in future dry times.
The bush is hurting everywhere at the moment. If we could get this done now, at least when we do get rain and we get all water flow down, we'd have some surety, whereas at the moment we've got nothing.
Pune Kerry local Trevor Smith believes the weir at Pune Kerry is too short and partly to blame for the town running out of raw water from the Darling River. The river at Pune Kerry between Wentworth and Menindee is virtually dry and the town has been relying on emergency water supplies for nearly 12 months. Mr. Smith says the time is now to build a higher weir that will store enough water for the town when flows return to the river.
We just haven't got any storage at all, which affects everybody. It's just a waste. Now is a perfect opportunity to do something with it because there's no water upstream. Ideally, it needs a new higher weir, probably with the ability to let small flows downstream when we are full, if you know the river goes dry again, so that it caters for everybody, not just a few. This area here at Pune Kerry seems to have missed out. Even tourists and that sort of thing, just to come and be able to throw a line in, like, not much fun catching mud on the end of your hook.
The Pune Kerry Weir was built in 2014. General Manager of the Wentworthshire Council, Ken Ross, is sympathetic to locals' concerns about the structure and says it is designed to prioritise fish passage over water storage.
It was a CMA-funded project for fish passage more than holding back critical water supplies. So while the funding provided through the Catchment Management Authority at the time was for fish passage, and the weir was obviously an integral part of that, and the crest level of the weir, I think, probably got a secondary thought. Someone designed a concrete structure for fish passage, and the spillway for the weir was possibly a secondary thought, and not enough level of engagement with the locals has occurred, would be my thoughts on it.
The weir is owned and maintained by Wentworthshire Council. However, Mr. Ross says the council does not want responsibility for the structure. He has lobbied two state water ministers without success to pass ownership of the structure to the New South Wales government.
I think there's two weirs in New South Wales under the ownership of local government, and that one is one of ours. We don't want ownership of this. This is an environmental regulatory structure within the passage of the Darling River, and that should be under the care and control of New South Wales Water, not a local government authority, being Wentworthshire Council.
Mr. Ross says Wentworthshire Council has asked the state government for a new weir, but has not received an answer. In a statement, the Department of Industry and Environment says the empty weir pool is a result of the drought. It says government-funded bores installed in 2015 are now responsible for providing the town's water supply.
That's Saskia Mabin with that report. More texts coming in on carp. Martin saying, hear, Tom. He's referring to a previous caller. Love to hear if there is any opposition to his opinions. Well, if you don't think that we should be fishing carp instead and that isn't a good idea and that we shouldn't be eating them, you can also offer your view, 0467 922 783. Or you can also give us a call, which is what Roy from the southeast has done. Hi, Roy.
Yeah, hello, back again.
Now, Roy, you think that the carp should be fished as well. Do you agree with Tom, our previous caller?
I didn't get to hear Tom, but I can tell you there's a massive amount of carp caught and sold in Australia's fish markets every day. The biggest amount, or what was previously anyway, some a year or two ago, of fish sold every day in the Sydney fish market was European carp, mainly because there's so many of them and there's so much of them in the system. Now, on the same token, there's people out there that eat a lot of carp through different nationalities and such and love it, which is good. Massive amount of bait used in the shellfish industry and the crayfish industry is European carp. Now, if that all of a sudden is gone out of the system, for the fishermen that are involved in that industry, there's going to be considerable pain for some considerable time. However, if they can roll through that, after a little while, or some time, the natural fish stocks, our golden perch and things like that, and Murray cod within the systems, which are at tiny percentages to what they ever used to be, will soon be back there and they can catch lots of them, and a lot more people seem to eat those fish than they do European carp.
Roy, so
but the European carp...
Roy, you're suggesting the... Oh, sorry. I was just saying, are you suggesting, are you saying that you would support the virus being released?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, they're a pest fish, for sure. But it's not going to be pretty for a while, absolutely. But they don't call them underwater rabbits for nothing.
So what you're saying is that, or what did Barnaby Joyce call them, the cane toads of the waterways? I think that was something that Barnaby said in his speech about. I'm not even going to imitate his pronunciation of carp. But so, Roy, you're saying really that there's alternatives. Once fishermen get through the hard times, there are alternatives out there to be fished.
Absolutely. The European carp breeds so readily it lays billions of eggs every time. So it out-eats and out-predates all our own native fish stocks, which is why European carp are such a pest, such a problem.
Roy, thank you very much for your call.
No worries.
That is Roy from the Southeast. To have your say and to join the conversation on the Country Hour today about carp, 0467 922 783, and again, our talkback number is 1300 222 891. But right now it is after 12:30, so let's find out what's making news headlines. It's good afternoon to Bridget Herman.
Good afternoon, Isabella. South Australia no longer has the highest unemployment rate in the country, with that dubious honour now going to Queensland. The seasonally adjusted unemployment rate dropped a full percentage point from August to September to 6.3%. The trend unemployment rate rose from 6.4% in August to 6.5% last month. Nationally, the jobless rate slipped to 5.2%, driven lower by a weaker participation rate with fewer people actively looking for work. The nurses' union has welcomed the closing of what it calls a legal loophole that threatened the safety of remote nurses. SA Best, the Greens and Labor all voted together to block the government's Regulations for Gales law, named after murdered outback nurse Gail Woodford. The regulations permitted nurses to attend remote call-outs unattended if a risk assessment is done. And the leading solar car competing in the World Solar Challenge has been destroyed after bursting into flames near Port Augusta. The driver started to smell smoke and pulled over to the side of the Stuart Highway and got out of the solar car seconds before it burst into flames. No one was injured, but the fire quickly spread into a surrounding grass paddock, which firefighters are now working to extinguish. There will be more news at 1.
Thanks, Bridget. Glad that the driver got away safely from that crash. Still to come on the Country Hour, we're going to be talking about the wine industry, because a new report that's out has said that the industry has fully recovered from its oversupply issues of the past decade. So you'll hear and find out how it's made that turnaround. Also still taking your thoughts on the carp herpes virus and what a potential release of that could mean for you, what effect it would have on you or your area. And we've heard a lot of talk already on the Country Hour about whether we should be fishing and eating them instead. Roy, who was our last caller, saying that they're a pest and we just need to get through the hard times, get the virus out, get through the hard times, and the fishermen can fish other fish. Paul on the text line is agreeing with Roy, saying that he is on the money. 0467 922 783 to join in the conversation.
Australia's new home of free-to-air football coverage is ABC TV and iView.
Buries it into the back of the net.
Throws it in, it's time to go. It's in.
Look for Stoke, lift it over. Phillip is a stunning goal.
Watch the best players from around the country compete in the A-League and W-League each weekend.
Cut in, shoots, scores.
And he scores a second goal. It is game on here.
ABC TV and iView. Australia's new home of free-to-air football coverage.
You are listening to the Country Hour. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau now, and it's good afternoon to Simon Timke.
G'day, Isabella.
Now, I'm just trying to think if it... No, it did. I did. I remember being woken up to rain overnight. How did we fare rainfall-wise?
Yeah, look, we've had, a couple of days' worth of a band of showers or rain moving across the south of the state. So looking at a couple of days' worth of rainfall totals here, you know, there's been quite a number of falls in the sort of, 15 to 25 millimetre range about the Mount Lofty ranges. A little bit less over the Adelaide Plains, mostly sort of the order of 5 to 15 millimetres there. A little bit further afield, most of the falls have been less than 10 millimetres, but there's a few bigger ones that we've seen around the place. Tintinara has had 17 millimetres. Another noteworthy one is Cook Plains in the Murraylands has had 21. Monarto's had 18. Malang 17. So a few places in the south have picked up the odd bit here or there. Even Port Lincoln's. Port Lincoln's had 8. Coffin Bay 6. And about the mid-north, a number of places sort of picked up to about 3 millimetres or so over that period. But sort of as you head further inland away from the coast, the falls haven't been so great. A couple of good ones about York Peninsula, 16 millimetres at Stenhouse Bay and Edithburg, Waruka up to 13 millimetres. So some places have done okay, but as I said, further inland, it's still mostly dry, unfortunately. And I guess the story ahead over the next couple of days is probably similar to that. We've got a high pressure system dominating our weather at the moment, centred over the west of the state. It'll move northeastwards overnight ahead of a cold front expected to move across the south of South Australia during Friday. So we'll see generally the winds, the northwesterly, western northwesterly winds freshen up ahead of that change, and then they'll turn quite a bit cooler southwest to southerly winds behind that change, so extending across the south during Friday. A chance of showers, essentially southern coastal districts, I guess, if you could imagine a line sort of roughly south of, Elizabeth in the northern suburbs of Adelaide there. South of there, there's a slight chance of showers following this change on Friday. About Kangaroo Island, the Fleurieu Peninsula, the southeast districts, so it's probably a medium chance, and then a higher chance about the lower southeast district. Those showers continuing into Saturday, we see the next high start to push in out to the west on Saturday. So we stay in an onshore southwesterly flow over the southern agricultural area. So for Saturday, we're still forecasting a slight chance of showers over the southern agricultural area, the far southwest of the Flinders district and the southern part of the Murraylands district. I think by afternoon on Saturday, they will have contracted to southern coast and the southeast districts. There's quite a burst of cold air coming up over the far south behind Friday's front. So I think on Saturday morning, I wouldn't be surprised to see a little bit of small hail in some of those showers just about the lower southeast district early on Saturday morning. Both Friday and Saturday as well, just a slight chance there could be a shower and possibly a rumble of thunder right up in the very far northwest of the state there as well on both Friday, Saturday, and even Sunday a chance up there. But by Sunday, most of the showers cleared away, just a slight chance about southern coasts of the lower southeast district, and as I mentioned, a chance of a thunderstorm right up in the far northwest. Most likely dry on Sunday, though. I think little, if any, rainfall falling with those thunderstorms right up in the far northwest. Could be a bit of a cold start on Sunday morning too, as that next high pressure system pushes in. We'll see the winds drop out and the skies mostly clear through the early hours of the morning. So it could be a little bit of a frost patch around the south of the Flinders district, northern part of the Mid-North district, and maybe over the western part of Eyre Peninsula as well on Sunday morning. And that was something I forgot to mention on my way through to tomorrow morning, Friday morning, a chance of a bit of frost around parts of the Mid-North Flinders and Murrayland districts as well. Through into the early part of next week, we've got drier conditions on Monday. No showers expected anywhere. Could be a little bit of frost about the Murraylands and upper southeast districts. Maybe a little bit of patchy fog to start off with about the southeast districts and Kangaroo Island as well. But no showers forecast for Monday. We start to see temperatures rise then too. It'll be getting a little bit warmer during the early part of next week as our winds turn around northerly ahead of the next trough, which reaches our western border very late Tuesday and then moves slowly eastwards across the far west of the state on Wednesday, and then remaining parts of the west and the south during Thursday. So with the northeast and northerly winds ahead of that trough, we'll see maximum temperatures rise. So it'll be very hot in parts of the west on Wednesday, and then with cooler conditions moving in with a south to southwesterly wind change behind that that trough. It won't bring a lot of shower activity with it by the look of things. I think Tuesday and Wednesday both most likely to be dry. Wouldn't be surprised if there's a flash of lightning and a rumble of thunder in the far west, but unlikely to produce any rainfall totals, I think. So most likely to remain dry even with those storms. And then once the change moves through the south on Thursday, I think there's a slight to medium chance we could see some showers over the agricultural area developing behind that change. So a chance of one or two showers around on Thursday over the agricultural area there. As far as rainfall totals go for the next 4 days out till midnight Monday, on the low side, generally less than 1 millimetre over the southern agricultural area, reaching 1 to 2 millimetres about southern coast and the Mount Lofty ranges, and the fall slightly higher about the lower southeast district, where I think we'll see some falls in the range of 2 to 5 millimetres. But generally speaking, I guess on the low side for rainfall totals over the next few days, Isabella.
Okay, thanks, Simon. Simon Timke there at the Weather Bureau. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now. And for the up and western district, tomorrow will be a sunny day. Overnight, it will drop to between 7 and 10, and then during the day, it will reach the high 20s. And for the lower western district, tomorrow will be a sunny day. It will drop to between 4 and 7 overnight, and then during the day, it will reach the high 20s. Let's look at more thoughts coming in on carp on the text line. JD at Narracourt saying that I agree with Tom on the carp issue, and Tom was saying that we should be fishing and eating the carp. JD here saying, but how do you fish huge numbers of them without catching the native fish and affecting their numbers? Thanks for your text. And anonymous text here saying, in Kununurra, in terms of, I guess, marketing fish, catfish was renamed silver cobbler and eaten. And this text is saying change the name, so don't call it carp anymore. Open to your suggestions about what you think it could be called and what effect you think the carp herpes virus being released would have. 0467 922 783 to join the conversation. It is 18 minutes to one on the Country Hour.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
Well, passion fruit from an interstate producer has been pulled off Woolworths shelves in South Australia after Queensland fruit fly larvae were found in some fruit. Now, PIRSA has asked for the passion fruit from a batch with a best before date of October 14 to be withdrawn from sale. Now, Biosecurity SA Deputy Chief Executive Mehdi Daruti has more details and joins us now. Hi, Mehdi.
Good afternoon, Zabu.
Now, what exactly was found in this passion fruit?
It was a few larvae of fruit fly in a couple of passion fruits coming in one of the boxes that we received from interstate. The origin that was coming from distribution was in New South Wales, gone to Woolworths, and obviously purchased from there. We were very lucky and fortunate that a member of the public was very well aware of the impact of this pest on our horticulture industry, therefore took photos and reported back to our officers. And our officers got into action with Woolworths, who are fully cooperative in this case, to withdraw that product from their shelves. As you said, the date, the due date for that product was 14th of October. We would be hoping that all have been consumed. It's just a matter of precautionary approach at this stage rather than an emergency response approach for us to make sure that we communicate with members of public, put more emphasis on the importance of this issue and try to raise the awareness to make sure if they see any matters with their passion fruit that they have purchased recently, or as a matter of fact, with any other pieces of horticultural products, they report that to the relevant authority.
So, Mandy, the fruit came from New South Wales. It was discovered and reported by a member of the public. Are there any ramifications for interstate trade?
We do have some nationally agreed protocols in place that works interstate when we import and export a product. There is a point of inspection at the origin of the host material and the fruit that comes to South Australia. That has been done to the best of my knowledge. That inspection took place in New South Wales. We are working with our with the relevant authority and our colleagues in New South Wales to find out that what could have happened here that we missed such inspection.
Now, and I just want to clarify again, with people that have bought passion fruit, what should they do?
There is a hotline number for fruit fly that we have. It's 1-300-666-010. We encourage them, obviously, when they cut them, they have a look at them. If they see the larvae, it's about half a centimeter whitish, that it's turning and spinning. If you find such a thing there, it would be very isolated, I have to say. Isabella, it could be just on those that we noticed so far. But if members of public purchase the fruit, they still have it in their fridge. They want to go and consume that. It's important to check that and to report if they see anything unusual to this hotline.
And just lastly, Maddie, is this considered a fruit fly incursion?
No, it doesn't. Two points I would like to put emphasis on. One is that it's a detection that happened. By no means it's called an outbreak of fruit fly. And as I said, it's just mainly precautionary and raising awareness exercise that right now we are going to go through, plus the fact that we can tighten up and we are going to the protocols that we have between the states for imports and exports. And the second part is that it's in the metropolitan area. It's out of the pest-free status, PFA, that we have for Riverland and other places, and by no means should be affecting any other part of our industry or their trade.
Mehdi, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That is PIRSA Deputy Chief Executive Mehdi Daruti. So if you still have any passion fruit purchased in October, be vigilant. Make sure you check your fruit carefully for larvae grubs. And if you do find anything suspicious, place it in a sealed bag or container. And as Mehdi mentioned, you can contact the fruit fly hotline on 1300 666 010 for advice. That's 1300 666 010. Well, let's move to the wine industry now, because the Australian wine industry, it's fully recovered from its oversupply issues of the past decade, according to the CEO of Wine Australia. An independent report by Ag Econ Plus was released yesterday, showing a 13% increase in economic contribution since 2015, with a growth rate of roughly 3% per year. Wine Australia's CEO Andreas Clark says South Australia produces more than half of the country's wine, with the state's industry employing over 8,000 people. He told Grace Whiteside the last independent economic report was 4 years ago, and there's been significant growth since then.
It tells a very pleasing result. Overall, grape growers and winemakers and wine tourism operators contribute $45.5 billion to the Australian economy. And the sector supports close to 164,000 direct and indirect full and part-time jobs. And what's critically important, these are jobs across regional Australia. Australian wine regions cover, you know, 65 wine regions across the country. So it's a real spread and diversity of regional impact, which is fantastic. Overall, the sector's grown by 13% since 2015, so an average growth rate of 3% a year.
And how does that growth rate compare to, say, 10 years ago?
Yeah, it's been a turnaround story. The Australian wine sector had a boom period through the 90s and the early 2000s, and then had a decade of challenges, basically. But we've firmly come out the other end of those challenges. It's still very competitive, mind you. It's not easy to turn a dollar, but we are certainly enjoying more prosperous times. And a lot of that is clearly linked to our export story. We export more than 60% of what we produce. So we're heavily reliant on working our export markets. And that's something our sector does particularly well.
So you would say that we are entirely out of the problems that the grape glut caused in the 2000s?
Yeah, look, we're in a much different position now. There's overall supply-demand balance that sits in the grape and wine sector at the moment. So, yeah, we are in better times for sure. But I always hasten to add, it is very competitive out in the export landscape. Obviously, we're competing against a number of other major producers, both the big old-world producers, as they're called, in France, Spain and Italy, but the likes of the Chileans, New Zealand, South Africa as well. So, you need to work hard to generate the returns, but we're certainly in much better times.
What sort of contribution has South Australia made to those countrywide figures?
Oh, look, South Australia has always plays a very important role, obviously. It accounts for more than 50% of the national production. So whenever you're talking national figures, you can read into South Australia being the engine room of a lot of that growth.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how the export figures are going and how that compares to, once again, say, 10 years ago?
Yeah, sure. So exports have obviously been really strong for the sector. I mean, you look back from 2014-15, at the end of that period of time, our total export value was $1.9 billion. We're now approaching $2.9 billion. So there's $1 billion in export value that's been generated over that period of time.
Andreas Clark, CEO of Wine Australia. Riverland winemaker Richard Angove says he's seen some growth, but international and domestic competition has been challenging.
Yeah, we've seen a small amount of growth. There has definitely been an uptick in export sales. Domestically, we've also seen reasonable growth, but things are still sort of what I'd probably say steady. It's good news, but certainly internationally, things are still challenging. And domestically, competition is as solid as it's ever been.
Tell me a little bit more about that export growth. How does it compare to, say, 5 years ago, say, 10 years ago?
Ten years ago, the export markets were certainly contracting. Our primary focus has been on changing our product mix in the export markets. So we've had some good success with our organic wines in a number of markets, and that unique selling proposition of being certified organic has certainly caught the eye of some of our distributors and customers in export markets as well as domestically.
And you mentioned the tight competition in the domestic market. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes, well, there's well over 2,000 wineries in Australia, and we're all vying for positions on retailer shelves and on restaurant wine lists. Yeah, the economy is growing, and so we are still seeing people spending money on wine, but Australian winemakers are continuing to make very good quality wines, and so when there's lots of good quality wines out there, it's always going to be competitive. But that's a good thing. It keeps us on our toes, And it makes us strive to make the best wines we possibly can.
Wine Australia have said on the back of this report that the Australian wine industry has now fully recovered from the wine grape glut of the past decade. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes, I would. Yep, absolutely. We've seen upward price pressure on grape prices due to demand, which is a good thing for grape growers. We've seen small increases in price points. I think the report said that there'd been an average price of exports had increased by 7% from 2015-16. So even though there's been a reasonable increase in the price of grapes, we've also been able to see a small increase in the price of the wine that we're selling.
That is Riverland winemaker Richard Angove speaking there with Grace Whiteside. It is 5 minutes to one on the Country Hour, and to politics now, because South Australia's controversial mining bill reform is likely to go to the upper house this afternoon. The Greens and SA Best have filed 69 amendments, which York Peninsula farmer Brenton Davey says would have given more protections to farmers, but it's likely that they'll be voted down. Mr. Davey says he and other farmers on the York Peninsula will continue opposing mining on prime agricultural land, even if the legislation passes.
There was a whole range of amendments that both Wifey Log and GPSA, Grain Producers SA, had put to both the Honourable Frank Pangillo and Mark Parnell to see some sort of leadway to give protection to cropping land, and this is before the upper house now, and I was sitting in on proceedings 2 days ago, and none of those amendments were accepted or passed, which is very disappointing.
And so I understand that you are fairly close to the hillside mine, or the proposed hillside mine at the moment. What's your standing in relation to that mine at the moment?
Yes. Well, I am vehemently opposed to the mining operation that they are proposing here at the hillside mine. I am under a mining lease under that, and I have flatly refused to do anything with the mining company, because I know that they just want to get a waiver of exemption and come in and destroy my land for very little or any compensation. I mean, compensation doesn't really play into it, because what we're looking at here is the protection, looking into the future, of agricultural land to be able to feed a growing population.
The Hillside project was approved under the current legislation, so this change, this mining bill, even if it had all these exemptions, these amendments that the Greens wanted, even if it had all these amendments in it, it really wouldn't make much of a difference, likely, to your situation. So I suppose, why have you followed this bill so closely?
Well, I'm following this bill so closely is because how it's affected me, I can see that it's going to affect every other farmer who's cropping. And if we don't make a stand now, the agricultural sector won't be the powerhouse that it is at the moment. We're having one industry trying to trample another industry for its own gain.
Now, the government has made the point that this bill is supposed to increase allow farmers to really negotiate with the mining companies. What do you say to that?
Well, the only negotiation is about compensation. There's no negotiation in to say, I don't want you coming in and digging up my land. That is out the window. All it is about is, we're going to give you some money to get hold of your land. That's the only mediation that the mining companies want.
The bill is passing to the upper house today. Looks like it will probably pass without any of these amendments unchanged. Just quickly, what's next for you and some of the other people around YP after this?
Well, we're just going to keep going with our own way, to keep try and hold the government accountable for not giving any leeway to the powerhouse of this state, which is agriculture.
That is York Peninsula farmer Brenton Davey speaking with Lucas Forbes, and we will obviously follow that issue and see what happens. It is looking likely that that legislation will pass without those amendments being supported. Also on carp, Dan says, great idea to rebrand carp to make it more palatable. Not sure if it would work, but a great way to retain it in consumer minds would be to simply swap the R and A around. Thanks for that, Dan. And this text here from Hansy saying, carp eat everything, including small native fish eggs. So if you stock the river with juvenile cod, too big for the carp to eat, then there'll be big numbers of native fish that will colonise the river. That is all I can read of that text, unfortunately, because we've got to get to the news because it's 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.